The thing about software is there's zero marginal cost to every copy of software. So if you built it and you've done it, and I take and do something with it, the only harm is now I can compete with you, but like that's what open source is, right? It's the silent infrastructure that runs the entire planet. And the other thing is like, you know, it's not just the software, it's not the thing at the other end. It is the mechanisms that make that thing possible. The challenge is we don't yet have enough literacy in open source to be able to have these conversations.
Hi, this is Brian Douglas, and you're listening to Open Source Ready, a bi-weekly series where we discuss the evolution of open source software and its impact on the tech landscape. Along with my co-host John McBride, we'll explore topics like open source AI, the business, and the life and sustainability of open source. Open Source Ready is brought to you by HeavyBit, the leading investor of developer-first startups. For more information, visit HeavyBit.com. If you're interested in being a guest on the show, or if you'd like to suggest a topic, find us at x.com/opensourceready.
Welcome to another installment of Open Source Ready. John, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Brian. I've been going deep on some AI personal projects, which has been a lot of fun. What about you? How are you doing?
I'm doing good. I actually just got back from brunch, weekday brunch, because it's
nice.
I'm not really supposed to talk about like the day we're recording, but it is Valentine's Day, the day we're recording. So I took the wife out because I've got kids, and it's hard to coordinate babysitting when you have kids and all that sort of stuff. But I'm ready to go. Got two cups of coffee in, and we have a guest. Matt, welcome on the podcast.
Thank you, Brian.
Cool. So Matt, you actually listen to the podcast quite a bit. We actually had a conversation months ago about just topics around open source, and you've got a pretty good background in the space. So why don't you let the listeners know like what you've been working on, what's your relationship with the space?
Starting with open source.
Yeah, let's go with that.
Yeah, I'm in the center of creating a new foundation that is designed to be part of the open source ecosystem. And it is called the Commercial Open Source Startup Alliance. There's a couple important things to that. One is, you know, it wasn't that long ago that you'd get some dirty looks in a room if you used the word commercial and open source in the same sentence, right? And I think we've matured as a culture. You know, it's not so much about cramming the worldview down people's throats. Like, we can have those discussions, but open source is unabashedly commercial. Some open source, excuse me, is unabashedly commercial. It doesn't all have to be commercial. And there's a giant economic opportunity to bring more capital into that ecosystem, which will spin off more intellectual property into the commons, which is what benefits everybody in the long run and is one of the benefits of open source. So I'm trying to build that ecosystem around startups and investors and really create a safe space for anybody who wants to have an open and honest conversation around commercial open source.
Yeah, and the foundation itself, is it officially open?
It is not. I mean, it's. So I'm waiting in line for legal to like perform all my stuff. There's some big transactions that are being worked on now, but I've got plans in place. We're tentatively looking to have an event in San Francisco end of second quarter. So like late May, early June. It will involve a lot of commercial open source stuff. Should be pretty interesting, I don't have the legal foundation in place yet, but I know what it's going to be like. And then we'll make a big deal about announcing it.
Yeah, and you hit the nail on the head, which is like, we talk about commercial and open source. There is like a cost movement, and I know quite a few folks that like in the VC side that have been involved in this movement. A lot of companies have chosen to think about what the product is and how they make money a lot earlier in the life cycle of open source. So as of recent, we've seen a lot of license changes for stuff that's been established. We saw license changes get reversed as well. But I want to actually jump in first and talk about this conversation we had off air about IP law.
Okay.
Because I thought you had a really, really fascinating talk around IP law.
Yeah, it really informs a lot of my decisions, and I'm happy to do it. And I think I said, do you know where IP law comes from? And
yeah.
And everybody gives me that look, and it's kind of an unfair question because I don't really expect you to know. But everybody feels like they should know the answer to that. The answer, so I won't make people twist in the wind. The answer is Article 1 of the Constitution. Like, it is right there. And if you read it, it's very peculiar because it empowers Congress to make laws that give the creator, the author, the musician, the inventor, limited time, exclusive rights for the thing they create and invent. Okay? But there's a purpose attached to it. There's a purpose. And that it is for promoting the sciences and useful arts. And science is capital S and art is capital A. So the theory was, essentially, and I'm going to simplify it, that the more knowledge and tooling and capability that we can distribute as widely as possible to society is going to have the highest benefit, right? So we don't want to create systems that encourage people to keep inventions secret or ideas secret or works of art secret, okay? We want to create a system that encourages people to do more of this. So we'll make a deal. And the deal is, if you create something and you agree that eventually it will go into the public domain. It doesn't say it this way, but this is what happens. I agree to put it in the public domain, then intellectual property law will protect you until that happens. But we know something, and that is everything will end up in the public domain. And so first thing is just the interesting thing, like we should pass any intellectual property discussion through the lens of, is it promoting science and the useful arts? And I think a lot of times we come up with no, but you know, the government's messy and you never get it right all the time, but yeah, maybe Disney shouldn't have the copyright to Mickey or whatever. You know, just happened to get an extension the year that it was expiring. So, you know, it's like all the mess of government, but in general, I think it works fairly well. So what's open source? Open source is just a different kind of agreement between the community or the developer and the combination of the stakeholders that the creator, who has exclusive rights to that stuff they created, that's all theirs, 100%, is agreeing to accelerate the contribution of that work into the public domain, essentially, to make it more available along that spectrum. So they're releasing rights, they're giving rights to the community away. And so when you start thinking about that, you're like, okay, well, there's all kinds of different, you know, first principle ways we could think about what function is open source having, what function is a project have, what function does a maintainer have, what function does a foundation have. And, you know, if we had 10 hours, I'd be happy to tell you all this. So why don't you pick the things that you either want me to defend or you want me to double click on?
We'll have you on a follow-up episode for sure.
Yeah. So in the context of, because like there's a lot of conversation around like, okay, we've got some projects. So HashiCorp had what was it? It's not Vault. Vault actually has another companion project that's open source.
Terraform?
Yeah, Terraform has OpenTofu.
Yeah.
And I just talked to OpenBao just last week, actually.
Yeah.
Which is the Vault version of that. But who owns the rights of, like, if it's open source, who owns the right of Terraform? Like, is it okay that OpenTofu shipped this competitor?
I mean, yes. So there's a written document. It's called a license. And that license says that all the code that's covered by this license, which was up to whatever version HashiCorp had contributed to until they changed the license. And again, change is not the right word. Okay, they didn't change the license. What they did is they said, the engineers that we pay so that they can go send their kids through college and write software and put food on the table and all that, the people that we pay to make these works, those works, we're going to keep to ourselves for a little bit longer than we normally would. So they just changed the license of the stuff from here on that they create with their own money, which, you know, it's not as evil as some of these other ways of framing it sound. Now, one thing I will say about it is there was an implicit expectation, right, that was mismatched. And I think both people had a mismatch. I think, you know, good intentions. I think if you had asked Mitch Hashimoto, you know, back before he had a corporate board and all that, I think he would have said, it's going to be open source forever. That's what I want it to be. And that's the other thing is I've talked to, you know, part of starting Casa, I've talked to all these commercial open source pioneers that have arrows in their back because they you know, did something that was characterized as a rug pull or something like this. And even if you know, reasonable people could argue and say, you made the wrong decision, right? You there's an ethical thing that you just didn't get right here. I can tell you, it was painful for all of them. And not a single one of them is like, I don't believe in open source. Like, it was wrong. No, all of them were like, it was the hardest decision I ever had to make. I was attacked by the community that I love. And I just didn't, it wasn't set up right. We never accounted for this situation. We never imagined this situation. And maybe we didn't solve it right, but we didn't have very many tools to work with. Anyway, I think it's very interesting when you go back to these first principles and you actually talk to the individual that are causing these decisions. It's a lot less, you know, conspiratorial, and it's something we could fix.
Yeah. So you're working in this foundation for commercial open source. there's a big question around capital investment in open source and like how money is distributed as well. Because like not everyone gets to the point where they're like, okay, like actually not everyone gets to the benefit of this point where it's like, oh, we have so much adoption, what do we do next? So the decision to eventually take on capital and like become sustainable and like eventually have a business around open source. Do you find that it's better if someone makes that decision earlier on, or is it something that's okay to like build a huge community and then one day add the company on top of that?
Wow. I think all paths are reasonable. I mean, I think the reality is different things start for different reasons. I mean, you know, I mean, there's a whole other, so the way I recharacterized the question was, where do new open source projects come from and how do they become sustainable? That's kind of how I think about it. And so where do they come from? Well, some of them come from because someone's trying to scratch their own itch, right? Richard Stallman needed to fix the printer driver or whatever, right? It's like some of these things. And I think that maybe it grows in popularity and it needs to take on other contributors, or maybe that's just that one person's gift to the universe. And maybe that's a crotchety old person that has the whole world on, you know, on leverage. And now we have to think of other things to do. How are we going to replace this? What do we, you know, it's like that, all that exists. But then that's just one model. The other model is you've got an enterprise where you've got, you know, a team of 2 to 25 people that are working on some really cool technology. And the enterprise says, you know what? This isn't core to what we do. We think that if we contribute to the open source, we can get some other peer groups of our company standardizing around it and contributing to it, we'll be able to, you'll get more money for our dollar, right? And everybody else will benefit and it'd be fine. And at that point, like it wasn't a commercial thing. It was commercial in the sense that, let's just take Kafka. It was commercial in the sense that LinkedIn was paying the salaries of the people that were maintaining Kafka, right? Well, those people decided they wanted to build Confluent. Right. Now it could have continued at just being Kafka and, you know, nobody builds business around it. And the same was like, you look at the labs at the, you know, the universities, you know, I mean, that's a path to founding a company, or it's a path to just some research that somebody gets a PhD around and then goes, doesn't just something else. I mean, I don't know if I'm answering your question.
It is true. Cause like I know a few folks in UC Berkeley, or recent graduates of UC Berkeley's like, ML programs, who now have VC-backed startups like instantly, like magically have investment.
Okay, so you did ask a question in there that I think I didn't answer yet. And that was, how long should people wait?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. So my opinion as an entrepreneur, you should preserve as much optionality as you can possibly tolerate, because you really don't know what the future looks like. And so I wouldn't start by open sourcing my code unless I had a really clear go-to-market strategy that depended on that. And then it's the faster I can open source it, the better. So if I'm cal.com and I'm like, the way to take on Calendly is we're just going to open source this thing and, you know, get a big plugin universe going and, you know, whatever the strategy, I don't know what the strategy is. I like the tool, I use it, but I don't know what the strategy is. But that was like kind of a day one startup-y thing. So I think you want to preserve as much optionality as possible. And when you make the decision, do it very mindfully, because there's some one-way doors or some doors that are very hard to not go back from. Once you've contributed your IP to a foundation, like it's the foundation's IP now, right? It's like a conservation easement on your farmland. You know, the Nature Conservancy now owns that. So here's the other thing. Startups are hard to begin with, but a startup that's trying to both execute a startup strategy and an open source strategy it's a geometrically complex problem. And that's part of my other passion. That's why it's the Commercial Open Source Startup Alliance, is because I think that's where we can have a huge impact. It also plays a way to attract good capital, but also I think one way to bring more capital is to make more investable startups and helping them understand those interactions, those complexities. Like if you decide to have your main growth vector be through your open source community, that is going to change fundamentally, it should, where you get to spend your marketing dollars, because you're going to probably spend a lot more on DevRel than you're going to on Google Ads, and what kind of salespeople you hire, right? You start with sales engineers, probably, I hope, if you're selling to a technical audience. Anyway, you see what I'm saying, right?
Yeah.
It's like having a strategy that involved the open source dimension and the other dimension is super complex. And I want to help people, you know, give them guide rails so they can make those decisions at the appropriate time and make them with some confidence, even if they are, you know, bet the company bets, which sometimes they can be.
John, I wonder if you have a question, because you just open sourced some stuff that you've been working on.
Yep.
Yeah, I don't know if you have a thought for Matt, and maybe he can help.
Yeah, I have been thinking a lot about this actually recently. So I've been open sourcing and building some AI agent frameworks in Go, partly because, you know, there's nothing really that exists like this in Go. And I think mostly because Go has, you know, some kind of weird abstractions around schemas and JSON serialization, which is critical for AI agents calling tools. But that's some of the nitty-gritty details. What I've been thinking a lot about is, like, you know, part of that adoption piece where, you know, open sourcing this almost feels like table stakes to get people to use the library. And then, you know, like years down the road, if I ever wanted to do anything that, you know, built on top of that, you know, I don't think you could even monetize a library. Even, you know, I know people have done it, and I know people have been like sponsored in the past. I'm thinking of like the Astro team and Sentry or Netlify sponsoring them, basically paying their salaries, like you said. But, you know, the adoption piece had to happen first. So I sort of see this like chicken or the egg problem, where it's like, you know, this is things I'm inventing that, yeah, essentially I'm giving away for free, but I'm never going to get anybody to use my thing that I invented unless I give it away for free first.
Well, you're giving away for free is your strategy for getting people to use it. That is, that it's the freemium version of your product, if you ever have a product.
Right.
You know, I don't want to be like super crass at all, but I think it really helps to just try to look at everything through an economic exchange window, right?
Yeah.
Like, look, it is perfectly awesome if what you get out of this is the joy of having other people use it, right? If that's all it becomes, like that, I do stuff like that all the time. I have plenty of stuff. Like, I'm not trying to monetize my blog post. I spent 2 days toiling over something, and, you know, it's a gift. It's a gift. And I think it's a perfectly reasonable way for an open source project to come into being and exist and maybe eventually go out of existence, or maybe eventually turn into something that is amazing. And the only thing that's going to restrict you, so your trade-off, right? Your trade-off of giving this away for free is that there's some chance that someone will beat you to the monetization around your own project. I mean, that's really the main downside, I guess. If you want, you create your own cap, you enable your own competition in a way that you didn't want to.
Yeah. I really want to get you and Adam Jacobs in a room to talk about this.
Oh, I love Adam Jacobs. Yeah, he was one of the first people I talked to when this was like this wasn't even a website yet. It's just like this crazy idea I had.
Yeah. We had him on the show, and it was kind of a mind-blowing conversation for me, because I almost had this reckoning of like all these past open source projects that I've been a part of at VMware and Pivotal and even AWS, and like sort of some of the missteps we've made. But, you know, one of the things he talked about was when companies quote unquote open core themselves, where you kind of open source the core part of this piece and then maybe you build on top of it, you know, and then really you'd sort of made it more difficult, or you've reduced the actual attainable market for this core piece of technology that now is just out there with an open source license to use.
I think there are plenty of counterexamples where that's not true. Android.
Okay.
How's Google monetizing it? They're building software on top of it that if you want authentication and these are the expensive things that Google's done, you have to have a license with them, and Google get the default search in the Play Store. And Android is by far, you know, right behind Linux in terms of, well, based on Linux, right? It's kind of reciprocal. I love Adam. And I think the thing that Adam and I really, you know, violently agree is you have to know what your plan is. Like, you have to think about it. Like, you don't have to monetize your open source. You don't have to get other intellectual property contributions to your open source. In fact, you don't have to truly OSI compliant open source. You know, some of them are these licenses. I don't know which one it is. Maybe the business source license, but it's like source available. So you can read the source code. And if we ever go out of business, there's a clause that you can build on top of it. But you don't have a license to do anything with it. You have to get a license from us with that. But every line of code that we write 2 years after it's written becomes part of the free version. And, you know, maybe 2 years is too long to the technology, but like it makes certain open source people prickle. And I understand, because it's lots of complexity and it isn't really a good thing that we should have. But from a, like, what are we trying to do from a society standpoint? That's pretty good to me. You know, it's like I could have an 8-year team patent, but I'm just going to do 2 years to you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry, I go on and on and on and on. But I think there's really lots of different, every situation is different and it's hard to put in a box. It's good to have models. You can say, I want to be like that, right?
Yeah. I think that's great. I mean, and you even brought up a piece there that I sort of wanted to touch on about, you know, things eventually going back into kind of the societal bucket and, you know, forwarding on, you know, the science and arts and everything. Those patents and those things eventually landing back in the public domain. One thing, and maybe I'm playing a bit of the devil's advocate here, that sort of pops up for me is the tragedy of the commons and sort of what can happen around these things that everybody's using and then maybe sort of deteriorate away or cause, like, you know, more trouble or harm to the ecosystem that they're a part of.
I totally know the argument. I totally appreciate the argument, but let's look at what really happens in the real world.
Playing devil's advocate here.
Yeah. So we've invented plenty of systems for co-owning cooperatively land, like all the roads in the United States, right? And we've got a system. Yeah, sure, it's imperfect, and you know, but we all contribute to this thing, and we all get to use it more or less, right? It's a common. And there's a tragedy there, really. So when people say the tragedy, the idea is like there's this common thing that's unpoliced, a common resource, and that someone's going to go steal, going to use more than they their fair share, and the whole society's going to crumble. And it's kind of like the, you know, why libertarian doesn't work. And, you know, it's like it's a philosophy. It's a worldview. Okay. But let's really look at this. So first of all, in real world, the community forms together and they're like, you do that again and, you know, we're going to, you know, hang your kid by his feet on the tree, right? So some of these do solve themselves, even if there is a tragedy that emerges that causes them, you know, sometimes we have to, democracies are hard, right? So we've got to overcorrect. Nobody believes that someone's going to really like burn down the garden, and then someone burns down the garden. So, okay, we need some rules. No burning down the garden.
Right.
So tell me a tragedy of commons in open source. You don't really have to, but if we were to have a deep conversation, you might find one or two, but like there's no tragedy of commons to Linux. There's no tragedy of the commons at Kubernetes, CNCF, right? Where is all this tragedy of the commons? You know, there are some examples where like this person on one, this thing that everybody's using is he's not underpaid, but you know, it's probably because he's surly and nobody likes him and he can't get a job as much as anything else. I mean, I don't think anybody's actively trying to not solve for risk in their software supply chain, right?
Right.
So the premise would be the guy who built this thing, you know, that XCD cartoon with the one guy, the one supporter, and this one thing that everything's going to go toppling. Like, you don't think we can find another 100 companies that can pitch in $1,000 and we'll just give this guy $100,000 a year and just say, please do this. And, you know, now we do that. And he says, no. Well, what are our choices? Let's fork it and do our own, you know.
Yeah. My hot take on this is that developers, especially solo developers of those types of projects, and I've experienced this honestly, we're very bad at like marketing ourselves or really like doing the business side of it, of going and asking companies for a couple $100 or $1,000 or something like, hey, you use this thing? Like, help me out, right?
Sure.
That leads into another question I had for you. You know, most of the examples that I do see around the tragedy of the commons in open source revolve around maintainer burnout and what that can do to the security supply chain within, you know, XYZ, all these other projects that consume a thing. Is there a maintainer burnout problem? Like, what has been your perspective on that?
I mean, yeah, there's evidence, just like there's a bus problem too, right?
Yeah.
So for people that know the bus problem is how small of a bus do you have to lose off a cliff before your entire project is gone? And some projects have a bus that holds one person, right? It's a kind of a horrible metaphor, but yeah, it's the bus. I mean, I think it's a little a variation on that. And it's actually, those are both variations on how do you build a sustainable project, right? Like with any organization, right? Like people are going to burn out. It's not like it doesn't happen. It happens in law firms all the time. So what do? You have a succession plan. You have you build systems in place. Now, okay, so that doesn't exist. Well, maybe we should go do it. Who should do it? Well, maybe one of these nonprofit foundations can find a little extra budget. Now, that's the beauty of a nonprofit foundation, actually, is like, you know, the Linux Foundation only has 108 funded projects, but it's got thousands of projects, right? But there's 100, maybe it's 118. It's something, got that, it's a 10% of the total about that bring in the money. Well, where's all that money go? It goes back to those projects and the rest is redistributed to those projects that can't fund themselves. Now, is enough of it getting to the right people? Probably not in some cases, but I think it's, again, these, I think these are all solvable problems. You know, I don't think it's like everybody's trying to like get away with, you know, getting one more day out of this poor guy. I just don't think the right systems have been put in place. And somebody has to do that, and it's hard. Like, give me another example. Like, I think it's perfectly reasonable that somebody would say, let's say we agree with intellectual property, the people that create are creating value, and they're voluntarily giving it over in exchange for something, a business advantage, a community, a dollar, whatever, right? Let's just assume that. Well, maybe the government should buy some of it, just like it does with land, right? And maybe it should eminent domain some things that are so important, you know? Some secret algorithm that TikTok has, let's go pay a fair price for it, put it in the public domain. We've figured out, we've solved this in other places, right? Anyway, I just think the challenge is we don't yet have enough literacy in open source to be able to have these conversations, right? Like all this stuff that we just talked about today, how many rooms could you walk in and like start the conversation where you are right now?
No, definitely not a Thanksgiving conversation for sure.
Yeah, right, but even with the practitioners,
yeah,
you know, it's amazing how people, you know, confuse these very basic things like free software and open source. Well, why do they confuse them? It's because they're confusing.
Yeah.
They're used to mean not just two different things. They mean used to mean like 20 different things.
Yeah, and it's also good to note as well as like you look at engineering, let's just say like mechanical engineering, like all the practitioners and how long that's been in the field. Like we're talking hundreds of years from industrial revolution. Like when it comes to software, like 1970 on, like the half-life of engineers, like it's much shorter. I guess what I'm getting at is like, maybe does AI basically make this more approachable? Because I this is going to be another one of these hot takes.
I wasn't expecting that question.
What I'm getting at is like, okay, I'm hypothetically a developer because I can prompt a full-on application and I'm leveraging open source. So now I'm more in vogue to have this conversation that we're having right now. I'm like, hey, who owns this code? Where does this go? I guess what I'm saying is like, is there a world where this becomes more pop culture?
I think it has to. I mean, it's the silent infrastructure that runs the entire planet. And the other thing is like, you know, it's not just the software. It's not the thing at the other end. When you think about it, it is the mechanisms that make that thing possible. And so let's look at Linux. Linux arguably is the largest installed base software that's ever been built. And it probably is one of the most complex pieces of software that ever been built. In December, there was one release that I was looking at just randomly. And I was like, what is in a Linux release? Because I'm not a developer, right? I'm looking at Linux. I'm sort of reading these things. And it's like 13,000 patches, I'm estimating this from memory. 13,000 in one release. From 3,000 developers globally, 200 companies paying for a large percentage of those developers to make those 13,000 contributions in one release. What private company could ever execute an innovation system like that? Not a chance. Think about that. Like, it's a fundamentally different way to bring technology. Like, you can't compete against that. So you better get on top. You better figure out another business to be in, like building servers that run it.
Yeah.
I actually was going to tie one more thing back to the tragedy of commons, because I think this is all really important. Another difference in tragedy of commons is when we tend to think of the tragedy of commons, we tend to see it in the real world. It involves a physical resource that actually can be diminished. The thing about software is there's zero marginal cost to every copy of software. So if you built it and you've done it and I take and do something with it, that's zero cost to you. The only thing that might be harm is now I can compete with you, but like that's what open source is, right? So I think there is an important dynamic where it's kind of this zero marginal cost, which actually fuels the argument that all of it should be open and free, right? How can you not give medicine to people who need it if it costs us nothing to do? How can you not give knowledge to people who can make use of it if it costs us nothing to give? And you're in a whole different place. You've got this ethical argument, which, and our compromise is, okay, you know, X years.
Man, this is...
Sorry, I didn't mean to do that to you.
Yeah, this is great. For me, the thing that I think about, again, that, you know, maybe I'm playing devil's advocate here again, is sort of the definition around open source AI and the physical aspects of that, because nobody, well, some people are, but people are not taking, you know, the 600 billion plus parameter models and running them on their MacBook or even a cluster of like 3800s or something like you need H100s and you need like these ginormous pieces of hardware and electricity really, and your power bill is just going to go up, up and up to run these, to fine tune them, to build on top of them. It seems that it sort of stands in contrast to that ethos of software being a sort of ephemeral thing that just can, you know, transfer bytes here or there. But then we get like open source LLM models. Maybe blockchain was like this for a little while, but that's kind of fallen out of vogue. You know, it's so much harder without the physical aspects, the physical hardware aspects to actually do open source AI or some of these like big and distributed computing things.
But it's also hard to run your own super collider.
Yeah, and somebody made this argument to me about Kubernetes at one point where it's like, it's hard to run Kubernetes yourself. And I was like, it is, but there's also software systems that are making that easier. And I would say today it's getting better and better. So maybe I'm making an argument to my own argument here, but yeah, what would you say to those, you know, like big picture aspects of like big systems that, you know, claim to be open source, but...
So let me say, because I think there's maybe different ways of interpreting that question. So is the question, even though the software is free, you have access to it, it's still this like elite group of people that's going to get to actually use it
because... Exactly.
Okay. Yeah, so it's an unsolved problem, but how have we solved things like this in the past? Well, look at any major infrastructure. I mean, a natural thing, I mean, you know, the internet was DARPA before it was private. So it's very reasonable that the government would step in at some point and, you know, maybe take a university and, you know, take whatever big badass data center they have now and make it bigger and badasser. Or maybe we'll just inherit the NSA's data center that they're aging out. That's like now a bunch of H100s or something. But I think there will be a common resource that's made available, like all the other things that are important to life, like electricity and water. And I just think it feels to me like that's what's going to happen. And whether you're using it as a consumer or you're using it as a developer or researcher or something like that, like we want as many people as possible researching on this stuff. And I think as long as those principles remain in place, which, you know, you don't see very many people talking about, that's why I think that's the role of like the Linux Foundation and these other foundations. It's like, we should be talking about it. Like, this is important. This is valuable to us as the society. This is going to make it better for our kids. And it's going to, you know, mean that we can solve all those problems that we want technology to solve. Like, what if an asteroid, you know, it's like, we'd love to have an answer to that. And if technology and knowledge is more widely distributed, chances are we'll get to that answer faster.
Yeah, that's a great perspective.
Yeah.
Well, I do want to be conscious of time because I do have a read that I think is really relevant to this conversation. So Matt, my question to you is, are you ready to read?
I'm definitely ready to be read to.
Read.
Excellent. So there's a paper actually came out of Harvard late last year, I think Q4, about the value of open source software. I don't know if you've seen this come across your desk. I know Jim had emailed this months ago in his newsletter. It came out of Harvard and it really pulls out a couple different gems, which is like 96% of all the world's software is maintained by 5% of the world's engineers. And they use a ton of data, like open data sets for this. The other thing that they showed up came together with was the Kokomo method, which I'll struggle to think of what the acronym is with all those C's. But it's basically like they identified the demand side and the supply side of software. So it got down to, I think, within trillions of how much revenue would be lost if enterprises had to replace the open source they depend on. And then they were able to attribute that to a single engineer. So I don't have the hard numbers, but it's in the paper.
Yeah, I think the way that I've interpreted the big number, the 80 billion number, and I believe that's called the demand side number, which means if all that software would disappear, this is how much we would have to pay as a society to recreate it. And so to honest argument, at one very superficial level, that is the economic value of that open source software, which is a big number.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of other economic values that suffer from.
Yes, I mean, 80 billion is like, I mean, that's a huge number, especially considering like, okay, we see things like Terraform, like, eh, man, everyone's on Terraform, like enjoying and like being able to ship very quickly, like being accessible to the cloud. If that disappears, that's a huge notch against everyone who's like dependent on this one system, which is why we now have OpenTofu, which gives us an alternative. And in the event that HashiCorp makes a different change, I'm actually not even sure what the adoption is for OpenTofu. I did want to have them on the podcast to talk about, I guess 12 months, they've been, I guess 13 months they've been at it. So it'd be interesting to find out about adoption. But basically, I thought it was fascinating. I've been noodling on that because my day job, been really thinking about how do you represent your effort and your contribution. Because like a lot of times we're doing open source on the job, off the job, on the weekend. How do you show that value back to your employer that we've, like, this is important work?
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. And I think that also gets down to, you know, one of the reasons that the Linux Foundation is successful is because it kind of operates at the center of really the three entities. You've got the person, right? The individual, me, I have a job, an employee, I'm an employer, you know, I'm a father, all these things. Then you have the organizations, you know, that's the company, it's Coca-Cola or Disney or Joe's Tire Shop. And then you have the projects, which is the community, essentially. It's a community organization that like sustains and holds that project together. And really all three of those constituencies, you know, are playing a very important role in this. And you have to balance all the needs across them. And there's value exchanges across all of those. Like everybody's getting something out of it. So to your question specifically is that the one thing that makes that not as simple as I just described it, oh, it's like these three things of the triangle, is that the individuals sometimes are part of an organization and sometimes they're part of a project and sometimes they're just themselves. And so I think the answer to that is you have to show them potentially three different ways to look at it depending on what hat they're wearing at that moment.
Yeah, it's a complicated problem.
But that's the answer, right? It's like as an employer, well, you said, how do you calculate the worth of that? I mean, it's lots of value to the company, right? So there's a recruiting, hiring value, right? I get access to better engineers on my important project, potentially. I'm one of the cool kids, right? Like nobody wants to work for Walmart. Oh, wait, they have Linux kernel developers? Okay, Walmart might not be that bad, right? So there's all these, you know, you can go through a bunch of them. It's not just the cost to the enterprise to replace that software, it's the advantage that the vendor or the contributor gets from all of that as well. So there's a lot more economic value that's created to the entire system than that one number we have, which is, you know, it's a nice big number and it's a good number, but it's just one piece of it, tiny piece of the total value added, I think. And then what's the value of that being contributed back into society? We should be able to calculate the net present value of that property becoming free to everybody. It's public domain. Faster.
Yeah, there's an organization out there that has all this data.
Get those Carver buffoons back here. We'll talk to them about it. No, but I think you're right, Brian. Converting it into dollar value is a really important way to talk about this.
Yeah. John, did you have any reads?
I had a very quick read this week. It was a blog post titled "Leaking the Email of Any YouTube User for $10,000," which, that doesn't really make a lot of sense. This was essentially a bug bounty disclosure from Google that they paid some of these hackers the $10,000 because they discovered a way to basically unmask or unwrap the email address of anybody on YouTube, which, you know, is kind of a big boo-boo.
If you blocked somebody on YouTube, I think if you blocked them, it meant you blocked it across all Google services, and there's some Google services like Gmail that exposed the email address that you blocked. It was something like that, wasn't it?
Exactly. And what they used was an old school Google product that's kind of been rotting away, and they just kind of followed the train with this. And my big takeaway from this is that, like, you know, people love to talk about, you know, open source projects rotting, you know, out in the open. But like big companies have this same problem where they just have these old services and old things sitting around that are rotting away and then being used by hackers to unwrap your email address from YouTube.
That is fascinating. But if anybody wants to reach out to me on YouTube, please sponsor.
There you go.
Like and subscribe. Excellent. Well, with that, Matt, thanks so much for the conversation. This was very insightful. And listeners, stay ready.
That's all we have time for today. If you're interested in being a guest on this show, or you would like to suggest a topic, find us on x.com/opensourceready. This show is brought to you by HeavyBit, the leading investor in developer-first startups. To learn more about HeavyBit, visit HeavyBit.com.